Beloved children of God, before I get started this morning, I do want to congratulate the Old Testament reader for today. You have to read Jebusites and Kenizzites. It's quite a feat. Before we get started again on continuing the story of Abraham and Sarah, I want to at least begin my own story a little bit. One of my daughters told me once when she was about 9 or 10 years old, and her mother was debilitated with MS, she would kneel beside her bed at night and pray to God to ask to heal her mother, night after night. And every morning, she was so full of faith that she would get up and fully believe that her mother would be healed. But it didn't happen that way. Instead, there were years of painful struggle as the disease took its malignant course, leading eventually to her mother's death from complications of the disease. So where was God? Where were God's promises for this little girl kneeling beside her bed at night? Well, Abraham was having a crisis of faith too. As Genesis 15 opens, God makes one of his periodic visits. Don't ask me how. It's called a vision this time. God makes one of those statements to Abraham that it's like one of your grandmothers would cross-stitch and frame and put on the wall next to her chair. Don't be afraid, Abraham. I am your shield and very great reward. Well, Abraham has about had it with all of these promises from God. And there's nothing to show for it. Time's running out. Abraham's patience is wearing thin. And for the first time that we've read, doubt and resentment begins to boil to the surface. You can hear it in Abraham's response. Listen to it without the sort of stuffy biblical prose. Yes, Lord, you are indeed always making big promises to me, but here I am, old, and still childless, and Sarah is, well, she's getting a little tired of this constant readiness. That's what your promises have gotten me so far. So let's get real here. I know, let's have Eliezer, my servant, my slave, become the heir. He knows the family business well enough. Let's just get on with plan B. In fact, we have legal documents from that day showing that it was the right thing to do if you didn't have a male heir to, that your slave would become the heir. To Abraham, all this traveling around, building altars, and trusting in God was going nowhere. And he figured it's time to do what was humanly possible. This was the first, but it will not be the last time that Abraham and Sarah decided to take the promises into their own hands. Lots of us, I think, come at times, whether we admit it or not, to the same point that Abraham comes to. We read and we hear these wonderful promises of God. We've heard them perhaps all of our life. And if we're honest with ourselves, we feel sometimes the same smoldering resentment, the same anger. What good are all these promises from God when life keeps on kicking dirt in my face? Living between the reality of life and the promises of God is sort of like standing with one foot on the dock and the other foot on a boat that's slipping away. While God keeps on saying, everything will be all right and I'll take care of you, your life seems to be falling apart at the seams. Like my daughter, we hear the promises about healing, about well-being, while disease continues its relentless pace. We hear God tell us, love never fails. But then a marriage falls apart. While the world seems to promise success and sort of instant rewards, God saunters along on a completely different timetable. My wife Jean likes to play with Photoshop in her photography. It sort of lets you crop pictures the way you want them to the essentials. So, for example, if a you take a great shot, but a stranger happens to get in on the corner, or there's some extraneous detail, you just crop it out. The Bible offers us a treasured picture of faith, but it never tries to make it pretty by cropping out the doubts and the struggles and the long waits and the agonies. And I like that because it makes me feel at home in the pages of God's Word. So what does Abraham do with, what does God do, I should say, with Abraham's wavering doubts? Well, it's clear that he doesn't squelch them. He doesn't reprimand Abraham, nor does he immediately fulfill them. First of all, God rejects the backup plan. No, he says, a son coming from your own body will be the heir. And then God backs up this assertion by giving Abraham a nature lesson. He takes him out in the starry night and scanning the stars with its innumerable, the skies with its innumerable billions of stars, God says, so shall your offspring be. And I always imagine Abraham thinking, just one would be enough. Abraham doesn't say it, of course. But somehow it seems that gazing at the universe that God had made gives Abraham something to go on, something to strengthen him. So what's the point of this astronomical lesson? It's not a foolproof argument. It doesn't bring Abraham any closer to a son or an heir. It proves absolutely nothing. And it's not really an argument at all. It's a revelation. Its purpose is to help Abraham to look beyond the immediate problems and to understand the ways of God in whom he trusted, the ways of God who had created this glorious universe. Somehow, under the vast canopy of stars, somehow gazing at the swirling galaxies, Abraham becomes able to see his life in a larger perspective and to give some trust to the God who set all these things in motion in the first place. It was a sign. It was a sacrament, if you will, to the eyes of faith. I've had similar moments. Maybe you have too. Moments when you just have a sense, peering into the eyes of an infant grandchild for the first time, climbing the high passes of the Rockies, listening to the centuries-old chants of monks in a monastery, or just every Sunday letting the wine of communion explode on your tongue. There's just this conviction, this sense that it's true, it really is, that God cares, that God can be trusted. And then it says, and Abraham believed God, and God credited to him as righteousness. This is one of the most crucial texts in the whole Bible. Centuries later, Paul was battling with his fellow Jews who argued that righteousness was based on obedience to God's law. And in Romans 4, which we read part of this morning, Paul recognized that this old text from Genesis is really the foundation of salvation by grace. Paul argues that 430 years before the law was ever given, Abraham believed already, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. It was not Abraham's obedience to the law. It was his trust in God that was reckoned to him as righteousness. See, righteousness means having a right relationship with God, and the very heart of that relationship, the very heart of any relationship, is trust, isn't it? Trust. And way back here in the dusty reaches of patriarchal history, we understand already how we are saved by trusting God's gracious promises, not by our own efforts, not by our own goodness, not by our own stratagems. Righteousness is not about human achievement. We aren't righteous because of some goodness within people or because we're such good people. God is not looking for a few good men or women. God is looking for people who, no matter how messed up their lives may be, no matter how much they struggle with sin and temptation and doubt, who will simply trust in God's grace, trust in God's promised future, even when it seems impossible. When God says, "Trust me," against all odds and all evidence, they do. And God reckons it as righteousness. He puts it in the asset column of their lives. Some years ago, I met a woman named Joan who told me her story. Outwardly Christian, went to church, went through all the motions of the faith. But as she described it in retrospect, she was in the driver's seat. God was in the back seat, or maybe stuffed into the trunk. Things were not going well. She spoke of a pain of a broken relationship, of depression anesthetized by alcohol, of frenetic work as an escape. She even contemplated suicide at age 22. And then one terrible day, she was assaulted by a robber in her apartment and stabbed 27 times. She lay bleeding to death on the floor of her apartment. And thinking she was as good as dead, she raged against God, a God who was not there for her, a God who would allow this to happen. But she lived. The medics got there in time. And she lived through a painful recovery and a rehabilitation that spent long periods of time in a wheelchair. And she also felt really angry at God who had allowed this tragedy to happen and allowed such pain and suffering in her life. One day, a well-meaning person showed up at her room and read her a text from Jeremiah. "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." Well, Joan really, really wanted to chalk this up to insipid religiosity. But she couldn't. Somehow the words lodged in her soul. And gradually it dawned on her that she had a choice. Either trust God for her future, or she would have to make a future for herself. She began to trust in the love and the power of God to bless her, even in those painful circumstances. And that made all the difference. She understood that God did not plan her assault. It had the fingerprints of evil all over it. But it was only God who could create a future for her, a hopeful one. Of course, there were still times of grief and anger, times in which the terrible memories would come back to haunt her. Looked at from a human perspective, she was far worse off sitting there in a wheelchair than before the assault. But that day, sitting in a wheelchair, her body scarred, she found a new life, a life that no intruder could ever steal, a life that no assault could ever destroy. But God wasn't through with Abraham. He continued his stream of promises. "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess." Old Abraham, so weary of promises with no foreseeable future, he wasn't sure his heart could take it anymore. And he says, "Oh Lord," he sighed, "how shall I know that it's true?" How often have you said that? "How will I know?" And God answered the question with one of the weirdest, strangest scenes in the whole Bible. Abraham is told to gather up some animals and birds and split them in two like chickens on a grill. Abraham obeyed and spread these bloody carcasses out in an open field and sits there. And all day, nothing happens. The vultures swoop down and he shoos them away. All day long, nothing but flies and vultures. Abram must have begun to worry what this was all about. And then at nightfall, it says, Abram fell into a deep sleep. A thick and dreadful darkness descends. First, he hears a prophetic word from God. Something of the future is laid out before him. And it doesn't sound very good, to tell you the truth. His descendants will not occupy the land for years and years to come. In fact, they will become enslaved by another nation and mistreated. God's plans work on a completely different timetable than ours. Sometimes it seems more like two or three steps backward before there's ever one step forward. But Abraham need not worry. The possession of the land, God says, lies in the future. If it's in God's hands, and Abraham can rest in peace when his earthly journey is over, knowing that God will keep his promises. Now, we don't often get a picture of the future to buck us up like Abraham did. In fact, I'm not sure I'd really want one at all. But remember that for us who read this, it is prophecy in retrospect. Looking back, we can see the Lord's hand through the history of Abraham and in Israel and of Jesus Christ coming up right up into our own lives and our own time. As one old missionary wrote at age 100, under the troubled surface of our world and through all the vicissitudes of mortal time runs the majestic course of the divine purpose. There's an old saying, where there's a will, there's a way. When someone like me says that, it's just a bunch of bluff and bravado. But spoken by God, it's absolutely true. God finds a way through the maze of history, through the messes of our lives, even through the tearful prayers of a little girl at her bedside, and makes a way. After the words of prophecy, a deep sleep falls on Abraham, and he sees something that's very strange and mysterious. Now, it's important to understand that this gruesome ceremony of the sacrificial animals was not something new to Abraham. Archaeologists had discovered ancient documents from Abraham's time and place describing very similar ceremonies. This was a covenant-making ceremony. An Old Testament prophet at Western Seminary says you can still see him today. The purpose was that the two parties of the covenant bound themselves to that covenant by walking together between those split carcasses. And it was a sign that if either one of them broke the covenant, the bloody curse of that carnage would be upon their heads. It was literally cutting a covenant. God was here entering Abraham's world in order to show his trustworthiness. So Abraham watched in a trance as a smoking pot and a torch passed between the pieces, symbolizing God's presence. This was standard covenant-making procedure, but there was something really, really odd here. What's odd is that Abraham is not an active participant in this covenant-making ceremony. He's a passive observer. He's watching what's happening. Only God walks the covenant-binding path that night. Only God bears the weight of those promises and of the curse should they fail. You see, in this strange and gruesome ceremony, God unilaterally binds himself in covenant, solemn covenant, to Abraham, and to you and to me, Abraham's descendants. God says, no matter what, I will fulfill my promises to you, and it does not depend on you. All you need to do is trust me. We can see more clearly what all this means centuries later when one man passes a loaf of bread and a cup of wine to his disciples and says, this is the new covenant that is made through my blood. Do this to remember me. Then, all alone, forsaken by friend and foe alike, he climbs the hill of Calvary. And there, the carnage of the Son of God hanging between two criminals reminds us of that smoking pot moving through the darkness between the bloody carcasses. And we grasp the lengths to which God will go to bear the curse and to keep his promise with humanity. Like Abraham, we want to know that God's promises will come true for us. We want our prayers answered, usually right now, our fears relieved, our wounds healed. Well, here's God's answer. Look back and see my faithful footprints through history. Look at the cross and trust in my unbreakable covenant of grace. Where there's a will, there is a way, and I will make the way. Trust me. Is that a lot to ask? What about that little girl praying for her mother? It wasn't easy. She went through in her life lots of pain and lots of grief along the way. Sometimes she was ready to chuck it all and walk away. And you'd expect that such an experience might destroy the faith of a little girl or stir doubts that would metastasize into full-blown unbelief years later. But it didn't. God kept holding on to her with loving arms. Through all the disappointments, all the waiting, and even the eventual death of her mother, God held on to her, and she learned to trust him. And God has used those very struggles of faith to equip her to walk with many, many people through tough times with genuine empathy and with steadfast hope. She knows that in the light of the stars and in the face of Jesus Christ, God can be trusted to keep his promises. In the end, that's all that God asks of any of us. Trust me. Trust me. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.